succession number 27341, reel 6.
From about reel 6.
Right, we got down to Australia in middle of February, and I went straight down to Nowra, which is south of Sydney, and joined 1830 Squadron there, where we did a few hours, about nearly 5 hours of flying. Up to the end of February, 23rd of February, and then again I must have had a week off. We must have had a bit of leave, because on March the 3rd I was doing flight drills and strafing, addles. That must all have been at Nowra. I don't know, but Nowra to Illustrious, yes. And then I flew on March the 7th from Nowra to Illustrious and landed on board and did one deck landing. And that was my first, if you like, operational deck landing. And it took me an hour and 55 minutes to fly from Nowra to join the ship, which is quite a long flight, really. So she must have been well out to sea by that time. And then we did a few more exercises then, going up north. So on March the 8th, I did some flight drills. And March the 15th, I did some more flight drills, an hour or two in each case. And then I started my operations on March the 26th against Miyako Jima, which was where we did this 3 hours and 15 minutes, an operational strafing fighter sweep. And then I took photographs, had strafed the airfield and shipping in the harbour. All our aircraft returned. Anyway, so that was it. That was the beginning of Iceberg, and that was the first day of Iceberg.
Can I ask you, before we go on to Iceberg,
yeah,
a little bit about how a squadron's organised on board a carrier like Illustrious?
Well, you had your flights, and you were allocated to a flight, and you worked within that flight all the time. Unless somebody was killed, that's where you were. We didn't do anything specially. We were briefed after, or debriefed after an operation. But we had no shipboard duties. We used to take watch occasionally, but mainly that was after the operations were over. Before that, we were allowed to do what we liked, really. It was pretty easy go. It wasn't difficult. It wasn't too structured. The Navy seemed to put up with us rather than that we were taken. We people kept in their squadrons and their flights and tended to drink with those units. The ship's crew operated as ship's crews, and they drank on their own. They didn't mix with us. They weren't very interested in us, it seemed to me, but then, of course, we probably weren't very interested in them, because we were so full of flying, and we were going into battle. And there was an anxiety behind everything then, because we weren't too sure of what was going to happen and whether we'd live through this sort of big change in our existence. So this anxiety and it became quite stressful, and we really weren't too interested in the ship or anybody in the ship, except it was a prison.
Am I right in thinking, though, with the squadron, you're a squadron as a whole, you have your own ground crew, that sort of
yes,
thing?
Yes, entirely like that, and stewards, and I was in charge of the stewards. But, yes, one one bloke would be the intelligence officer, somebody else would have a job of armaments, parachutes and things like this. You were all given a job to do, which you did or you didn't do. Nobody took too much notice of what you were doing anyway. But frankly, those early days have all passed in a bit of a blur, because we went straight up and into action, and the getting up to the Okinawa area was quite quick. I mean, we left Sydney on March the 7th, and what is it, 19 days later we were in action then. And we were twice, I did 6 hours and 40 minutes flying on March the 26th. I did a combat air patrol of 3 hours and 25 minutes, as well as the fighter sweep. So it was pretty tiring.
What was the combat air patrol? What would that involve doing?
Flying over the fleet on the lookout for kamikaze aircraft. And there would be a couple of flights over the fleet from one or the other of the carriers, whilst the others were off doing their fighter sweeps or bombing raids on the islands.
Had the kamikaze attacks started?
Not yet. Not yet. No, but there was an element of concern about that, and I did several of those combat air patrols. I did three in 2 days.
What kind of duration would they be?
Well, 3 hours approximately, combat air, and 3 hours on the first strike, 3 hours, 15 minutes.
When you were doing, say, the combat air patrol, how tiring is that when you're doing it? Because I imagine you're not only flying the aircraft, but you're looking around and...
Well, when you're doing combat air patrol, you've got a flight of four aircraft, and you're spread out. And you're flying a course, and then you switch around, and you fly back over another course, and so keeping around the fleet, really, at a fair old height. You might go up to 30,000 feet, certainly 20,000 feet and above, so that you could come down upon any attacking aircraft and arrive more swiftly because of that. So the job was really one of guarding the fleet. Combat air patrol, that's what it was all about. And we didn't do anything other than chase off the odd bogey to begin with, because there were reconnaissance aircraft coming over to look at us from, I think, from Formosa and probably from Okinawa. But then, of course, the Americans started to... When the Americans had landed there, they stopped their activities, but they were probably coming down from Japan as well. That wasn't that far away.
When you spotted a reconnaissance aircraft, would you have had much opportunity to catch up to it? Or
that, well, more often than not, they scuttled off as soon as they spotted us anywhere near. They were off as fast as they could, because they were there to get information and not to... cause any problems. We didn't. Actually, I didn't spot anything. Not for a long time. And we weren't vectored onto any aircraft on those early days. We weren't sent off to find anything. There was nothing there.
Was it actually tiring doing that, though, the kind of combat air patrol? Would you find it fatiguing flying all the various things?
Dead boring, because you have to be very alert. Because they could have come out of anywhere. They could have come out of the behind you. So you're always doing this and looking at that. And you're on oxygen most of the time, because you're too high not to be. When we got down to sort of below 12,000 feet, we'd come off oxygen, because we had to try and keep as much oxygen as you could, in case you had to chase somebody for a long time. And I found that a bit boring, but... exciting, because you never knew what was going to happen. You just did not know anything could have happened. They could have come out of the sun at you or anything. And although the fleet would alert you if there was anything nearby, they were all on the lookout as well for their own aircraft. Of course, they had radar, and they could pick up things, but they didn't always pick up stuff, and they didn't pick it up until rather late, because if there are a lot of aircraft in the air, which one was ours and which one wasn't, you know? So it got a bit hairy from time to time.
Can you take me through that first attack that you made?
The first one. Yes, right. Well, we arrived over the target, which was covered in... We arrived, I think we were about probably the second flight in, and there was a lot of gunfire, ACAC fire, and the air was filled with all these black puffs, which I'd recalled seeing in film. And I thought, oh, there it is in real life, you know. How strange. And then we got over, and the CO said, right, well, let's go down, boys. And off we went and peeled off and went down in a sort of line abreast. And I think I must have been in the second line down. Anyway, we went down and across and over and shot up aircraft and buildings, mainly biggish buildings, that looked like aircraft hangars and things, and revetments. And... there was an awful lot of stuff on the ground, military stuff. Gun emplacements, quite a lot of those. And aircraft park areas, you know, where the aircraft might have been. And then... we sort of strafed over the airfield. The bombers had come in and bombed. They went in first with their bombs. So I think probably there was a sort of fighter sweep and then a bomb sweep and then a fighter sweep, that sort of thing. And this went on for quite a long time. Not with us. We'd done ours. We were off, you see. But I hung around taking these photographs that I've mentioned, a job that they'd given me to do, and they brought this camera on board and put it on before. They said, "You'll take photographs, John." I said, "Yes, okay. What do I do?" They said, "Well, you just take photographs." And I said, "Well, yes, but do I?" "No, no, it's automatic. You just point your aeroplane side, because the camera's down there. Just fly alongside something and just poke and then just take the camera and take a photograph." Well, I took all the photographs I could. But I don't know where I went. I had a rough idea, and so I pointed out what I thought I'd done. And that was it. And it was quite hilarious, really, because they laughed and I laughed, because no one in all my training had ever thought to give me a camera and send me off to do some photography. Not one person. In fact, I hardly knew the first thing about cameras. I was a little country boy from New Zealand. What did I know about cameras? And so consequently, ignorance was bliss, but nevertheless, I did it, and there were some quite good photographs taken.
What did you take photographs of?
Well, I took one photograph of a ship being hit with from a Corsair, which looked quite striking. Otherwise, it was a township, and the coastline around. Which was quite interesting from the point of view of the vegetation, but there were no guns on the coast that I could see or anybody else could see. So. In that sense, it was a bit hilarious. It was a bit useless, I suppose. But nevertheless, there was some good came out of it, in that some of their photographs were liked and thought well of. And I took some photographs of the airfields and bombs hitting the airfields. So those strikes must have been going on the whole time I was there. And I probably hovered around for about 30 or 40 minutes before I went back.
When you strafe the airfield,
yeah.
How much time do you have really to pick a target, or do you?
Very little, really. You have to be quite. The two things that worry you, because there's aircraft on either side of you when you're going down, and you're trying to pick a target, watch your airspeed and things like that, and look out through the gun. Well, really, you're aiming down there, but you're also conscious of the fact. But your speed's building up rather a lot, and you don't want to tear your wings off or your tail or something. And then you watch your altimeter too, just a little bit, to make sure that you don't go too far down. Although you think, oh, well, I can see where I am, and I know I'm not that. I've still got a bit to go yet before I need to pull out. And then while you're doing that, you're trying to think and saying, well, is there any aircraft down there? Can I see any aeroplanes? Well, I didn't. But I did see one, and I had a poop at that. And I pooped at something else, a revetment or something, and a gun position. And then I pulled out. And then the little red balls start to go past my head when somebody was firing at me. So I took fright at that and got the camera working and did my stuff around the island.
You were telling me off the tape earlier on that the importance of only making one pass on the airfield.
Yes. Well, we only made one actual attack, each of us, because to go back was hazardous, and we were told that, don't go back, make one attack and go. And that was sort of drummed into us. But those who did go back invariably got shot down. It was unfortunate, but one or two of the lads were a bit hairy and thought, oh, yeah, I spotted something, I'll go and have another go, instead of waiting for another day. No, I'll go back and have another go. And invariably they got shot down, and that's what happened to Winnie Churchill, who was a great New Zealand pal and also was one of the great sort of heroes of the Fleet Air Army. He a bit of a daredevil. He and his friend Jack Parley, both of them were pretty senior pilots, both of them lieutenants. Jack Parley got a DSC, Winnie got a mention, I think, at dispatcher, but he was killed, and unfortunate it was that happened, because he was a marvellous rugby player and a wonderful lad. But he went back. Cameron went back. He was shot down, but he was captured, and not had he was one of the few who didn't have his head chopped off.
How accurate were the Japanese gunners?
How accurate? It's astonishingly good. They were dead cool, you know. They weren't frightened. They were all, it seemed, were initiated into Buddhism, or Bushidism, which is the cult of the warrior, of the samurai. And because I spent about 18 months in the army, New Zealand, after the war, back in Japan, in the occupation forces. And they gave me a commission, but I'll tell you that later. And anyway, this Bushidism business, I think it was largely terror. I'm sure they were frightened, but they were disciplined, and they would fire, and they'd keep firing in the face of whatever was coming. And they did a pretty good job. I think the Japanese gunners were extremely accurate. Very cool under fire. They'd lose a lot of men and still keep going. So they weren't not brave. They weren't cowards.
And you've described, obviously, the sensations as you flew across the airfield strafing. How did it make you feel after you'd done a strafing?
Well, you felt a bit euphoric. You know, you're alive after all. you had to do it several times before the fear got to you. But when the fear got to you, you were very reluctant, because you can't help it. You get frightened. And it is a fearful business, being frightened.
Is it a question almost of the first times you make those attacks, you not knowing what to expect, and as the more attacks you make, you understand what's going to be facing you?
Yes, I think that was it, because when you go in, first of all, you're attacking really rather like a training exercise. Your mind is so taken up with the aircraft, its characteristics, it's doing funny things that you're not used to. You're becoming associated with this thing, this monster you were flying, as an experience, a unique experience. And it was, you had too much to take on board, really, because although you'd done it in practice, it isn't the same. as doing it under fire. Quite a new, novel thing, this being under fire and having the enemy banging away at you. Because even though he may not have been firing at you, you're conscious of the fact he's firing, and that's enough. Because you can see it. You can see all this crap coming upstairs to you. And you're in cloud some of the time, and it's black. So the experience was a bit, to begin with, early on, it was all over and done with before you're really conscious. It was only afterwards you start to reflect on how hairy it was and how difficult it was going to be going on doing this. And that's when you reflected, when you got back to the ship, oh, I didn't like that much. It wasn't very nice. Still, we'll go on with it. And you did. You just went on doing it. But we were lucky in one way that we had these strikes, and then we had combat air patrols, which were much sort of lighter work in between. So you see, on that first week, for example, from the 26th to the 31st of March, I did only one sweep. That was on the first day. One fighter sweep, see, and then three combat air patrols up to the 31st. And then I did another combat air patrol on the 1st of April. Another 3 hours and 10 minutes, and then back to fighter sweeps over Ishigaki, which is the other island. There was Miyako Jima and Ishigaki Jima. And Ishigaki, strafed aircraft, it says here, dispersed on airfield, one burnt. All return to Vic. So I obviously hit one, and it burnt. So that meant it had an engine and some petrol in it, one assumes.
But I've actually heard when attacks are made on Japanese airfields, a lot of the time the aircraft weren't seen to be burning, so
no.
It was difficult to assess how much damage you
had. That's right, yes. Well, this one did burn, and that was over Ishigaki, and that was a 3-hour, 15-minute flight. And as I say, everybody got back home, so that wasn't too bad.
Is there an element in when you're flying in combat as well? Do you have to get over the idea of being able to use the aircraft in any way that you
yes.
want?
You become one with the airplane. As you, what you think of doing, you find you're doing. It's as though your mind takes over and becomes part of the airplane. It's an uncanny thing, really, but this is where seat of the pants flying, I suppose, which you were really taught doing all these fancy aerobatics and strange flying, it taught you to become as one with the aeroplane. And the aeroplane did what you wanted it to do, and you didn't know you were doing it. You weren't consciously doing something. You say, I want to go down, I'll do that. And you're doing it while you were thinking about it. It's really an uncanny business. I suppose you drive nowadays in the same sort of way when you drive a motor car. But it's quite different in an aeroplane in that you're up in the air. And this aeroplane is doing things which you think, oh, I'll go around, have a look over there. And next thing, you're down and over there.
So it's almost become the mechanical functions that you were learning in training have disappeared.
Yes.
And that you're actually more concentrating on what's going on
around
you.
And you know all your instruments, you know where everything is, and you're actually operating them without even looking at them. And that is really what fighter piloting is all about. You are part of this mechanical thing. You're part of it. You're a piece of machinery yourself. Actually involved in the mechanics of fighting this aircraft, and it really is quite thrilling.
And to what degree would you say the Corsair was suited for those roles of strafing?
I think as a fighter bomber it was wonderful. As strafing it was a marvellous aeroplane. It could get right down low. It was a wonderful gun platform. It was pretty good as a bomber. And But as a gun platform, it was the Japs hated it. They called it the Whispering Death. It was that sort of, it had a quiet roar, and these powerful guns. It's sink a ship. You could punch a hole in the deck side of a ship, and it would definitely knock it out. It was really a very powerful machine. And some of our people did sink ships by gunfire. I hit a coastal ship, a little, because all shipping had to be sunk because it was part of the economy of Japan. There were no roads through Japan in those days. Everything was taken by sea. So all the foodstuffs and petrol and stuff that was wanted had to be taken by sea or by rail. So we were attacking railway stations and engines and things associated with the rail, coupled with airfields. But there were no roads to be attacked because they just didn't have roads. When I got to Japan post-war, you couldn't drive from southern Honshu up to Tokyo. There's no way you could do that. You had to go by train.
Is there an element then that targets were prioritised? I'm not thinking obviously airfields were the main thing.
Our job was to keep aircraft movements at a standstill. Our job was to block enemy activity from the south going up to help the defenders of Okinawa to fight the Japanese who were being attacked by these Americans. And our job was to save the Americans from that sort of hazard because Formosa was Japanese held, full of aircraft, and all the islands were full of aircraft. I mean, there were three airfields on these two islands, Ishigaki and Miyako. And Formosa wasn't that far away, and they were flying up at night. And they'd fill all the bomb craters in during the night and get aircraft to come forward and refuel. So every day we had to go and bomb again. And every night they'd fill up the holes. And it's a strange thing, but post-war, a chap called McCarthy went to Okinawa. He was a reporter, I think, for one of the Independent, or one of these major newspapers. And he had found a chap living in Japan who had been a small child on Ishigaki. And he described how he and his family had been moved out of the town and forced to live in the mountains of Ishigaki. Well, Ishigaki was a little tiny island. It didn't have a mountain. When I pointed this out to this chap, McCarthy, he wrote back and he said, well, of course, he said a door is a mountain to a four-year-old. And, of course, I realized that. But it was only hilly. And it was not very hilly at that. But they'd sent all the native inhabitants, the army, up into the hills. And they took over the town. And here were we being reluctant to bomb the town, and it was full of bloody army. So, but I did drop a couple of these napalms on the army. So I think probably it did some good.
Was that in the first week of the operation? Or
no, later? No, it was quite a bit later before we did that. It was. I don't recall napalm being dropped off. Hold on. I don't know that I ever recorded the word napalm.
It may not have been known as napalm at that time.
No.
And I was wondering, actually, with the napalm, though, how did you feel about carrying it? Not so much about its effect.
Well, we weren't conscious of any sort of... No, I didn't worry. I didn't like it. I didn't like it because I thought it was too risky to me, not to the Japanese. didn't like the Japanese. But I didn't have any, just a sort of tender feeling, you know. I thought, well, I'm carrying this load of rubbish. I hope I can get rid of it fairly quickly, which, you know, in the main we did. We got rid of it on our strike and sweep, and so we just drop them off. But I don't know that I actually recorded napalm as such or dropping anything other than bombs. We dropped a few bombs. Let's see.